I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, Vietnam and South Africa try to end illegal trade of wildlife. In India, the opposition is capitalizing on the Colgate scandal, and a Thai general has been accused of interfering in the Red Shirt investigation. We have this and more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Vietnam and South Africa are set to sign a landmark deal to help stem rhino poaching and the rampant trade in illicit rhino horns in Southeast Asia. The agreement comes months after South Africa stopped granting hunting permits to Vietnamese nationals earlier this year. The wildlife monitoring network TRAFFIC has welcomed the news of the deal. In its latest report on the illegal trade, it calls Vietnam the worst offender in the rhino horns black market. Richard Erwart speaks to Naomi Dork, program coordinator from TRAFFIC.
It appears to be readily available, but it is an illegal product here in Vietnam as it is around the world. So it's a little bit hard to actually quantify how much is available. And Vietnam's role, you know, is definitely one of a consumer, but also potentially as a transit country.
Why do you believe that these products are produced from rhino horn are still so popular when there is so much information out there to suggest that basically people should avoid them if they want to prevent the illegal poaching going on?
Yeah, I think, again, a quite complex issue here in Vietnam and other parts of Asia. You know, the rhino horn has appeared in traditional medicine literature here for many, many centuries. And so the current surge is sort of a re-emergence of some of those uses, plus the belief that it can help to address the more recent issues, things like cancer and strokes, and also, unfortunately, a little bit more sort of flippant uses of such kind of products is things like detoxifying after hangovers and other hard nights partying. So it's that resurgence and that re-belief in the product and what it can do, but also a great deal of it is about the status that comes with that. You know, it is an illegal product. It's incredibly expensive, so that there's a sort of ingrained idea that has a higher value, that it's of better quality. So it brings with it some status as well. If you're able to produce some rhino horn, then it you know, implies quite a lot of things behind that.
Now, governments in Southeast Asia, obviously Vietnam included, have in the past been accused of failing to do enough, really, to essentially enforce what is, of course, an illegal ban on this trade worldwide. So the fact that Vietnam is ready to sign this agreement with South Africa, I presume, is at least a positive step, that they're trying to do perhaps what they should have done some time ago.
Yeah, indeed. And you know, we're really trying to advocate and push here and in South Africa for not only signing of this agreement, because it would be in many ways a recognition of some of the issues. Now, the Memorandum of Understanding doesn't just focus on rhinos, it focuses on wildlife crime in general. And so it's a really key step for us in terms of two key governments recognising the seriousness of wildlife crime. You know, this problem's not just restricted to South Africa and Vietnam in terms of either a source country for rhino horn or a consumer country. You know, it's a global problem. And having them sign this would very much sort of recognise that on the global level, because it has become quite a big item in the media, in the news. You know, there's a lot of attention on it. So it would be a public display and recognition of some of the problems and, what importantly, what they can do to try and address them.
At TRAFFIC, do you regard Vietnam as being something of a hub for this trade in Southeast Asia? I know we were speaking on the program quite recently about the availability of products made from rhino horn in Laos, but the suggestion was that most of those products had originally come through Vietnam.
Yeah, we do. I mean, it's definitely Vietnam and this sort of corner of Southeast Asia, definitely, while it's difficult to quantify exactly what role they play in terms of consumer versus transit versus sort of, you know, modifying those products in some way. Vietnam is definitely central to that, as is Laos, you know, that they, the products are available there, as is China, because despite being removed from traditional medicine there, you know, rhino horn is still seized there and it's still available on the market, albeit, you know, not openly available because it is known as a as an illegal product.
Could this sort of deal that, that's about to be signed between Vietnam and South Africa be applied also in terms of the ivory trade?
Yes, I mean, it could be in terms of the ivory trade also is a little bit tricky here in Vietnam. The ivory trade's not as big a problem or not, a, you know, the consumer market here is much smaller and the product has disappeared from the market. In China, you know, it's a very complicated issue with them regulating the trade. There's lots of talk in the media at the moment about CITES considering lifting a ban on ivory trade. This kind of deal would be necessary in a lot more detail for any of that to even be seriously considered. It, you know, you have to have very, very strict regulations in consumer countries as well as source countries, and a much, much stronger and detailed sort of agreement would be necessary between countries before that could even begin to be considered.
And in terms of this deal, in terms of preventing Vietnamese nationals from getting hunting permits in South Africa, what does that mean in terms of saving the rhino?
Hopefully, I think, it's one step forward on that, you know, a recognition of Vietnam's role as a consumer and transit country in the rhino trade is extremely important. For the government to sign an agreement to work to stop that is an incredibly big step forward here, given that there's still reluctance to admit Vietnam's role in the trade system. So I think it's an incredibly important step that way. It would also, the agreement also talks a lot about trying to address the issues of demand, because, you know, it's very much not just an issue of dealing at one end of the trade chain. We can, you know, work to prevent poaching in South Africa, but unless the actual demand reasons and the consumers are addressed, then that potentially puts rhinos in other areas at huge risk. So it's really important that it also includes looking at demand, and the agreement does talk about that and provide some information in terms of getting Vietnam to lead on a comprehensive demand reduction campaign or strategy.
That was Naomi Dirk, the program coordinator from Traffic, speaking to Richard Ewart. India's opposition has threatened to block all parliamentary bills unless Prime Minister Manmohan Singh resigns over a coal field scandal. They've made their demand despite a report from the Auditor General clearing Dr. Singh of any wrongdoing. But the report does suggest the government lost billions of dollars in revenue because it failed to follow due process when Dr. Singh was in charge of the coal ministry in the second half of the last decade. One of India's leading analysts, Dr. Amitu Palit, says he doesn't believe Dr. Singh will resign, but the opposition can still do some political damage. He speaks next to Sen Lam.
For the period during which these minefields were being auctioned and the process that is being alleged not to have been transparent is a time when Dr. Manmohan Singh was holding charge of the coal ministry. And that apparently seems to be the main point which the opposition has picked up for making this a personal affront against the Prime Minister himself by suggesting that he is responsible for whatever processes or lack of processes which led to this kind of a situation that's been reflected in the Comptroller and Auditor General's report. I think that's the biggest issue that the opposition is trying to bring to the forefront.
So how serious is the opposition, the BJP, Bharatiya Janata Party, how serious is it when it calls for Prime Minister Singh's a political scalp?
The stock of the government, the United Progressive Alliance government in the centre, is very low. It has not been able to push things through on the economic front. It has not been able to take decisive policies. The state elections that took place in the early part of the year did not produce any positive outcomes for the government or its allies. For the Prime Minister himself personally, it has been a period of disappointment since he has not been able to move ahead either on the political front or on the economic front. The only capital that he has in his favor, and that is something which he has had right from the beginning, is his personal integrity. That is finally, through the scandal, being brought under the scanner. There's no way the government can defend itself positively in terms of any achievements. The only fact that it had in its favor was probably the fact that Dr. Singh stands head and shoulders above the rest of his colleagues because of his own personal integrity and very clean image. It has given the opposition an opportunity of getting back at him on his image. You know, if you look at the Controller Editor General's report and the findings that it has produced, I don't think it is personally indicting the Prime Minister at any stage. All that it is simply saying is that the open bidding process should have been followed during the auctions of the coal mine fields. Now, obviously, as the guardian of the ministry, the Prime Minister cannot completely absolve himself of the responsibility that why an open bidding process was not followed. But then, there could also be the alternative argument that the open bidding process is just one possible efficient way of allotting mine fields. The government has followed other processes without violating any terms and conditions and without giving distinct favors to any of the bidders, however inefficient that process might be, to go ahead and allot the minefields.
The opposition BJP, of course, has vowed to obstruct bills in Parliament until the Prime Minister resigns. Now, it seems to me such obstructionism is happening already, given the slow pace of economic reform so far. But do you think the opposition might be able to deal some real political damage here to the government?
Economic damage is probably not going to be enormous anymore because the economy as it is in a bad shape. But I think the more important point is that now that's happening in August 2012 and the BJP has taken an aggressive position on the issue of corruption by personally indicting the Prime Minister, irrespective of whether the charges are convincing or not, is a reflection of the fact that till the next election dates are announced, I think the BJP senses that it has a very strong chance for pushing the government into the back seat, because the government hardly has any political capital on the basis of which it can go into the next elections. And what I would expect is that in the remaining part of this year and the next year, the BJP and the rest of the opposition would adopt a more and more aggressive posture. So it is extremely important for the incumbent government under Dr. Singh to send a signal that is capable of handling all these charges smartly and positively. If they cannot do that, then they really have far more trouble in store for them.
Human Rights Watch says the Thai government should order the army's commander-in-chief to stop interfering in the criminal investigation of the 2010 political violence. Last week, General Payet Chanocho told the Justice Ministry's Department of Special Investigation not to accuse soldiers of killing demonstrators during the government's crackdown on the red shirt protest in 2010, in which at least 98 people died and more than 2,000 were injured. Who should take responsibility for the violence has become a political hot potato in Thailand, with suggestions the army is maneuvering to lay all the blame at the feet of the former prime minister. Bill Bainbridge reports.
In April and May of 2010, the long-running standoff between redshirt protesters and the Thai government came to a head on the streets of Bangkok. Asia Director for Human Rights Watch, Brad Adams, says there's little doubt about the general outline of what happened during those days.
We have photographic, eyewitness, forensic testimony showing that soldiers shot into crowds, that snipers were deployed along the elevated train tracks in Bangkok, shooting into monasteries, Buddhist pagodas. And we also have evidence that black shirts within the opposition were also deployed and were shooting at soldiers and police officers.
He says while not one soldier or government official has been held accountable for the deaths and injuries, Justice Ministry investigators have gathered evidence on both individuals and military units. But General Prayut Chan-o-Cha's intervention may prevent any prosecutions from ever taking place.
Well, he has told the chief investigator and his staff to back off, to stop talking about the role of the army. And in the environment in Thailand right now, where the army is very powerful, and General Prayut has a reputation for being a very strong-willed person, this is enough to make sure that the investigation grinds to a halt.
General Prayut has also moved to close down another critic, filing a complaint against Robert Amsterdam, the UK-based lawyer for both the Red Shirts and former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat.
It's a criminal form of defamation. It would involve the possibility of me going to jail for years. The party that calls itself the Democrat Party in Thailand, as well as the army, regularly use the criminal law power of the state to silence opposition. And so they frequently make use of these type of charges to silence critics and keep people like me from entering the country.
And so is that what this will do? It'll keep you from entering the country, or are you actually prepared to go there and fight these charges?
Well, firstly, I'm prepared to go. But make no mistake, the idea of me getting a fair hearing in Thailand is remote.
Robert Amsterdam is not waiting for the Thai investigation. Instead, he's launched proceedings on behalf of the Red Shirts in the International Criminal Court against Upasit Wichachwa, the Prime Minister at the time of the violence.
We've had a lot of people from the Thai army come forward covertly to hand us evidence, including evidence that snipers were deployed. We've provided that evidence to the ICC, and you know, I have to be honest, and what I tell my clients in Thailand is that this is a very, very uphill battle.
Those proceedings may well go nowhere, but Brad Adams of Human Rights Watch says it's likely that the Thai army is working on a deal to see the military exonerated and the former government take the blame for issuing the orders.
I don't think that deal has been sealed yet, but I think that's what some people in Thaksin's camp want. I think that's certainly what a lot of people in the army want. The problem is, of course, that the Democrats have historically been very close to the army and very close to the palace. I think it would be a difficult deal to be finalized. But that is essentially what Prayut is trying to say. He's trying to say that the army didn't do anything, which is nonsense. But even if we did do something, we can't be held accountable.
Whether Thailand's current Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat will side with her justice ministry or her army chief remains an open question.
I don't know really what Yingluck's position is. She's a weak prime minister. She's been put into her position by her brother, who's in exile, Thaksin Shinawatra. And it may be that she isn't necessarily so much a party to this as an observer. I don't know. It's very hard to tell. When I met her a few months ago, she made a very clear statement to me that she wanted to see accountability for the abuses, that this was a core value of her government, that it was complicated, and that she was committed to it. And I have to say, I took her at face value, but Thai politics are very complicated, and her position is not necessarily the one that's calling the shots.
In order to receive financial reparations from the government, families of Red Shirt members killed during the violence had to sign a settlement forfeiting their rights to file a court case against the army for civil damage, meaning that without criminal prosecutions, those people who lost their loved ones may never see justice.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. And finally on the program, the Solomons Prime Minister Gordon Darcy Lillo says assistance from Australia and other regional countries will continue for quite a while. The military component of RAMSI, the Regional Assistance Mission in Solomon Islands, will withdraw in the future. The Prime Minister was in Australia for talks with leaders about the bilateral relationship, which become more significant when Australia led the Pacific regional response to ethnic tensions in Solomon Islands in 2003. Gordon Darcy-Lillo tells Bruce Hill that Solomon Islanders need to prepare for life after Ramsay, although he says a continuing external presence in the country will remain for some time to come.
But the thing that you've got to understand is that as you make progress, there's going to be a change in the level of engagement. You don't expect full military people to be there when the situation has actually come down. But you would continue to have a more civilian, more development kind of cooperation on the military or the defense front. For instance, you know, civilians of the maritime exercise within the region, you know, to ensure that, you know, we have a regional stability presence that, you know, will be able to have people to have a better, you know, in a social and stable situation to live.
Is the situation in the Solomon Islands stable enough now, do you think? Do you think that the risk of that ethnic tension, which we saw in previous years, has gone for good?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's pretty difficult to explain this to you, but, you know, if you ask people, for instance, who were there 4 weeks ago, for instance, you know, at the Festival of Pacific Arts, they will say to you that, look, you know, Solomons have actually graduated to a very stable society because that was the first time that we have not seen the presence of the military visibly on the streets. We have backup of the police, the civilian police, but it is the people that have actually helped with the organization and helped to ensure that, you know, everybody are well-behaved and that we have a trouble-free festival. So that shows the kind of maturity and the changes that have been brought about into the country.
Well, now that the military component of Ramsay is starting to be withdrawn, is there still going to be a need for some sort of civilian external presence in Solomon Islands in the form of advisors and that sort of thing for a while?
Well, of course. I mean, you're talking about the military personnel. I mean, you've got to have them within the region anyway. I mean, you have them in a very stable, democratic society. But they do normal security alerts dealing with, you know, higher-level international security issues like money laundering, human trafficking, and that sort of thing. But more importantly is basically helping in the region, helping to manage our maritime zones.
How do people feel about this, I mean, emotionally? It's sort of like having someone come from outside to help the country. Sure, they're giving help and people are grateful for that. But there's a kind of a, why do we need outsiders to help us in the first place, you know?
Well, I mean, you can only be in the country that have gone through the pain and have experienced the pain to be able to fully understand the kind of feeling that people have. It was a great relief, you know, to people, you know, when they see the country, you know, quickly return to normalcy. When people started to see that, you know, they can go on with their own life, recommencing their own commercial and enterprising activities, started to earn income and plan their own family, getting, you know, students to education and linking to better opportunities that advances the livelihoods of families and members of the family and so forth. I mean, these are progress that, you know, as humanity faces, not only in Solomon but elsewhere, and we can actually see the impact that it has on people.
Although Ramsay was led and very largely paid for by Australia, how important was the contribution from other Pacific Island countries, you know, as small as, you know, Niue and Samoa and Tonga and Vanuatu and Papua New Guinea and New Zealand? They all sent people. How important was that part of Ramsay in making it work?
Well, I think it's the social connection. It is the connection to the locals, where the locals can better engage with Pacific Islanders and Melanesians that have the same mode of operation in a very simple society, than as opposed to an advanced society like Australia. So it's significant in that way, that you can use them as a front line to be able to talk to people, get an opening, and then launch a good program of engagement.
Well, as you say, things are happening. Things are much better now. There's a return to stability. The military component is leaving Ramsay. Can you look forward and see a time when no external assistance will be needed in Solomon Islands?
Well, we cannot say that sort of thing because, as you know, that, you know, countries in the Pacific are vulnerable. I mean, we have to see the realities of the vulnerability to climate change, vulnerability to other international illicit illegal activities and so forth that threatens, you know, the governance security of this country. And so there will still be a need, you know, for us to have an engagement, for instance, you know, with bodies like Australia and New Zealand and even the multilateral institutions to be able to help, you know, the country to harness the resources that, you know, they have and diversify the economic base of the country. These are kind of engagement that it is not totally exceptional only to countries like in the Pacific. I mean, there are advanced countries that have gone through serious economic problems. Like, look at Europe, for instance, that they have to rely on each other for engagement and relying on international financial institutions to refloat the economy. I would say that, you know, the region is requires the engagement of all, you know, members of the region. And at times, you know, you would see that, you know, programs like Ramsey, for instance, you know, that has proven, you know, the success of regional partnership and participation, that, you know, must be, we need to understand it fully and then have it, you know, to be operated in a way that to the success of the country. And we have seen that, you know, to happen in Solomon Islands, and it's a good credit to the region.
Solomon Islands Prime Minister Gordon Darcy-Lillo speaking with Bruce Hill. And you know what? We're now out of time. Yes, that's right. Another show has just ended. But before we go, if you wish to contact us and let us know what you think of the program, you can always write us an email. And our email is very simple. It's pcj@pcjmedia.com. Once again, pcj@pcjmedia.com. While you're online, if you wish to catch this program again or past editions, visit our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. That's www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. We also have a Facebook page for PCJ, that is. Just do a search for PCJ Media, PCJ Radio on Facebook and join the group. And you can also post your story ideas and suggestions there as well. Anyway, that's it. So we have to leave you right now. So on behalf of the whole team that helped put the program together this week, I'm Keith Parent, wishing you well, hoping that we'll see you in 7 days' time for another edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Bye-bye, everyone.
This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5... This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet... This is PCJ Radio.